I'm Matt Piller, host of the Business of Biotech podcast, and if you're listening to my voice right now but not seeing my face, maybe you haven't heard that we've launched a new Business of Biotech videocast page under the Listen and Watch tab at bioprocessonline.com. There, you'll find hundreds of videos of my interviews with biotech builders, categorized by topic like finance and capital markets, regulatory, discovery, and manufacturing. Don't try it if you listen while driving, but be sure to check it out when you get where you're going. Go to bioprocessonline.com, hit the Listen and Watch tab, and choose Business of Biotech in the dropdown. Welcome back to the Business of Biotech. I'm Matt Piller, and it's a special day here in the studio because we're going to be talking in circles, circular RNA, that is, with Orna Therapeutics CEO, Dr. Thomas Barnes. And if you're watching, you can see that as such, I've brought along with me my dear friend and colleague, Anna Rose Welch, who is editorial and community director for our relatively new Advancing RNA community at Life Science Connect. Welcome, Anna Rose.
Thank you, Matt.
Awesome to have you here.
It's awesome to be here.
We're uncomfortably close right now.
We share a wall, and now we share
nothing.
Yeah.
Yes. Collectively, Dr. Barnes and Anna Rose have likely forgotten much more about RNA than I ever knew or ever will know. So you're in good hands today if you're into RNA. For its part, ORNA, Orna, that is developing circular RNA therapeutics delivered via lipid nanoparticles to treat indications, including B-cell lymphomas and DMD, in addition to some discovery stage vaccine and other therapeutic programs. Dr. Barnes, who's been at the helm there since 2020, previously co-founded or led a number of biotechs, including Intellia and 11 Therapeutics. It also serves as an executive partner at the investment firm MPM BioImpact. Dr. Barnes, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you. And I want to start out by getting to know you a little bit before we kind of dig into the company and where you guys are going with your therapeutics. Your academic experience in genomics stands for itself. You've got a Cambridge PhD, a Harvard postdoc, a McGill fellowship. Rewind the clock quite a bit and tell us why when and why you decided to take that academic experience into industry.
Well, the story actually begins when I finished my undergraduate. So my undergraduate in the University of Sydney was majoring in genetics with a minor in biochemistry. And that was cool. What I realized coming out, and the Australian program is for a basic bachelor's degree, it's a three-year program. And the fourth year is optional, which you spend in the lab if you want to do that extra thing. So I was very interested in doing that. But in coming out of that, I was pretty sure I didn't want to be an academic. That point in time represented the end of all the forward momentum from high school, and you're going to university, and you know that's it's all on a track. And then it's like, now what? Yes, so I could go do a PhD at that point, but that I wasn't sure that that's what I wanted to do, and that was the direction I wanted to go in academia. So I actually took a year off doing a variety of odd jobs, in fact, ranging from working in a department store to being a taxi driver, and in the end. There was a biotech company that was starting in Sydney, Australia, just like they have in America. This was a long time ago. Yeah. And so it was in the early days. So this is in the 80s, early 80s. And so I thought, well, that could be interesting. Let's try that. So I got a job there. And very shortly after joining that, I was like, oh, yes, this I understand. This I get. I love this. I don't like academia. And what is the this that I was liking? The this is the teamwork, the fact that everybody across the whole company is pulling together at the same direction, and that the pace at which things move are not limited by your own clumsy fingers, but that ultimately it's everybody's hands working together that pulls things forward at an incredible pace. So it's much more stimulating, and there's a much stronger sense of camaraderie across the whole organization, whereas in academic labs you have these fiefdoms, you know, my lab, you get your stuff off my freezer shelf kind of mentality. And so that sort of team sport aspect of science was instantly appealing. So I was there actually for 4 years.
What was your role there? That initial first blush with industry. What was the role when you started?
Well, I was a research assistant, and I got promoted to a senior research assistant at one point. But it was back in the cloning days where you know, ooh, you know, we you would clone a gene, and that was exciting, and that would be a big paper, it would be a big event. So that's what we were doing, cloning and expressing proteins in E. coli.
Mm.
That's what the world was doing back then.
Yeah.
So at one point I thought, all right, maybe I want to do more than this. You know, what would that be? I considered various, I'm doing this sort of career thing here. I don't have to be going on quite so much about it, but I think that's maybe. No,
please do.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I mean, you know, it's a frame of reference. We'll fast forward if we need to.
Okay. So I was thought, well, maybe I should go do patent law, because there are very few people who had a science and patent law background. But in the end, I got some advice, which is some of the best advice I ever received in my life, which is always pick the option that leaves most options open. Mm. I've used that piece of advice many times. And so I realized that the answer to the puzzle then was go get a PhD, because I can still do everything I was contemplating on doing. That was one of the things I was going to say. So I should go get that, because it's also a terminal degree. There's nothing more after that. Yeah. So then I launched off to do my PhD and then a postdoc at Harvard. But the, you know, the plan was to go back to biotech.
Mm-hmm.
When I left, I was going to go back to Sydney, but then I kind of got stuck ultimately in the Boston area, which is, well, now it was certainly up and coming, but it's now certainly the epicenter of biotech in the world. And so basically I got stuck like a fly to fly paper.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll talk about some of the stops along the way, I think, throughout the conversation. But I'm going to hit the fast forward button real quick here for a minute, because you've had exposure to a lot of different modalities, a lot of different areas of biotech. What was it that turned your interest toward RNA?
Well, it was basically that every time I changed jobs, I liked to do something different. The opportunity came up to join Intellia. I was working with Nesson Birmingham, the original CEO of Intellia, on another project. This is associated with Atlas Venture. When the possibility of getting Intellia going came up, and that was just a very appealing, you know, editing was very new, it was very cool. And so...
still is.
It still is. I would say it was so cool, it was white hot. Back then. I had the opportunity to join a CSO, which I did. But interestingly, everyone in that space was thinking about doing cell therapy, ex vivo manipulated cells, because that was technologically tractable, or doing some sort of viral delivery editing. And so you had CRISPR Therapeutics that picked the first one, and Editas was an exemplar of the second one. Now, we certainly had, at Intellia, we had an alliance with Novartis on the cell therapy, but we also were trying something a bit kooky, which is to try and do RNA delivery through a lipid nanoparticle where the editor was encoded in a messenger RNA. The guide RNA was also in the mix, and they would all get sorted out once they got into a cell. One would get expressed. The protein would find the short RNA. The two of them would then trundle off to the nucleus, cut some DNA and do some damage, literally. That seemed science fiction-y, but we thought we'd give it a shot. And again, now I'll press fast forward. We got it to work some years later. And I think ultimately when the first clinical results came out in the summer of 21, it was international front page news, editing in vivo for the first time. And we were the ones who showed that such a thing is possible. Now, of course, everybody thinks, well, of course, you want to do editing that way. All the other ways are so fiddly. But before we started, it was science fiction. Yeah. So I wasn't drawn to RNA so much as I fell into it.
Yeah. I'm curious about that. Like the science fiction, white hot, you know, cutting edge, brand new kind of attraction. What is it about Tom Barnes that makes him what's the opposite of averse? Like embrace. What is it about you that makes you drawn to? Like how it takes a special person to embrace something that is so, you know, more dramatic than nascent, right? Mm-hmm. And make a career of it. I mean, you could. Yeah, well, I guess my point is you could have
risky business.
Sure, like you could have done a bang up job in antibodies, for instance. But no, you chose to go do some cutting edge gene editing and get into the RNA space. What is it about your makeup that makes you embrace that?
Well, I'm a risk tolerant person, firstly, and I understand biotech. In other words, I don't, in my mind, require each attempt to be. It doesn't have to be a home run. I understand that, you know, we'll give this a go, and if not, you know, if there's a what I call a noble failure, ultimately, then you know that you can pick up and do something else. At least that's my approach. So that's one reason why I'm risk tolerant to that. But the other thing is, you know, I'm very curious. I'm interested in a lot of things. And so I do, I think it's a bit of my makeup too. Maybe I'm a sort of a science hipster. I kind of go off the mainstream and I like going counterculturally, cross current or something. I don't know.
Yeah. That's interesting. And it, you know, that feeds like some of the questions I have around how you establish a business here in this space when you have sort of a counterculture approach, like what perhaps difficulties that might create for you. Before we get to that, tell us the genesis story of one. By the way, Anna Rose, it's really nice to have you here because when I can't think of a word, Anna Rose is a...
Here, I'll be your thesaurus.
She's a trained poet. She's very wordy. Yeah. You're like a living...
Sometimes wordy is not great, though.
A living, breathing thesaurus sitting next to me in the studio. So tell us Orna's founding story. What got things started there?
Yeah. So Orna has a very traditional start in the sense of if you go back to how biotech companies used to go. So it used to be that academics would discover something and they would start a company and pull some sort of nascent team together and then try and get venture interested. Now, of course, these days, venture typically goes and scours science directly from universities and so on and builds the company to their own sort of preconception. But Orna was really in that old mold. So our story goes back to 2016 or 2017. Dan Anderson of MIT is listening to a talk on naturally occurring circular RNA in China and goes, huh, I wonder if that could be an interesting variant on a theme. Of course, Moderna already existed at that time. 11 was coming through, and it has already been known for attempting at least the RNA-based editing. And Dan had a long history in LNPs and RNA in any case. And so he gave the task to a graduate student, Alex Wesselhoft, who completely blew it out of the water. PhD finished in 3.5 years, you know, green thumbs at the bench, and solved the fundamental problem, which is how can you make circles efficiently at scale and large enough to be useful and figure out how to make them useful by getting them to express things. So he did all that. And so that was the basis of IP that was filed. And then they thought, well, there should be some value here. And so the company, a company was formed. It wasn't called Orna at the time. And they basically encountered NPM Capital, as known now, NPM BioImpact. And this is in the 2019. So the first funding came in mid-2019, but part of that funding was a conception that what this company should do with its circles is to see if it could figure out a way of doing an in vivo thing, but not editing at this time because the RNA is going to be transient. But can we get the RNA into immune cells? And if we could we disrupt or displace CAR-Ts and cell therapy completely because it would be so much more convenient? So in other words, it's a very high science concept that predates me. And it was really an idea that came from NPM. And so money came in and they started building the team immediately. With Alex on board, and I started talking to NPM. I had left Intellia earlier in 2019. I was scouting about for things to do, and I started talking to them in October or so, and we kind of sealed the deal in December, and so I started in early 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And you had no idea that the world was about to blow up and become all RNA all the time.
Exactly. No,
it was faded.
I like to think I had a crystal ball, but I did not.
Nobody did.
Yeah.
It is all RNA all the time. And it's like, and how many how many letters now precede RNA across the spectrum?
Quite a few. Oh,
there's quite a few.
It's, yeah.
Letters.
Shape. Coding, non-coding. It's
Well, that's one of the things I think that's cute about the term we invented for what we do. And it's something that I noticed early on is that up until that time, certainly in the papers that Alex and Dan had published, And in the early materials, it was called circRNA because CIRC, lowercase, because that's what it's called. Mm-hmm. That's the standard abbreviation. But I realized almost immediately that people get confused. They look up circRNA, and there's thousands of papers. There's a lot of papers on circRNA, but none of that is relevant to what we're doing because ours is completely synthetic. We're not extracting circRNA from cells. We're making it in vitro, designed to exactly encode exactly what we want, and it's done made in a different way than it's made in vivo. It just in the end looks like a circle. So we need a branding for what this is. And I remember being at a bar one Friday, as one is. And,
it's where all the great ideas come from.
Exactly, thinking of a name of the company as well. Actually, really, that's what I was trying to do. And I thought, you know, Moderna's kind of cute because it's like mode RNA and their abbreviation mRNA.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, we need something. What could be RNA? Is there an RNA something we could call the company? And I thought, well, I don't know. ORNA. I thought, oh, that's cute, because then we could call it also ORNA, where the O just means circular. It doesn't stand for an O word. It just means circular. And so that was just born in a flash there. And so we changed.
The important question is, what were you drinking at the time?
It was probably a beer. So that's when the name came in. So that was shortly after I started there.
Yeah. I'm going to ask both of you guys to unpack for me a little bit the advantages, differences between circular RNA, ORNA, and specifically in Orna's case, synthetically produced ORNA from. And we could go long in this conversation. I don't want to go too long. This is the business of biotech. It's not the science of biotech. But for our listeners' benefit, maybe just more color on where ORNA fits in the landscape that, you know, we've seen linear RNA for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, the thing that intrigued Dan back in the day was that even to this day, people don't really know what naturally occurring circles do. There's a number of theories, but to my instinct, I don't think any of the theories have really nailed what they're there for. They don't doesn't quite feel right. But the one thing that people know is that naturally occurring circular RNAs hang out in cells a lot longer than the linear RNA counterparts, particularly especially if it's derived from the same gene. The circular piece is more long-lived than the linear piece. So circles live longer than lines. Mm. And so that was really what Dan said. Well, okay, if you could do a whole technology based on circles, it'd be better. Longer half-life is better. And that's so we've gone on to show that that's true, and I think it's been shown now in multiple people's hands. But what we discovered along the way is that circular RNA, I call it the gift that keeps on giving, because it continued to show these unexpected advantages over mRNA. And the way I would summarize it, again, coming back maybe to the business and less on the science, is that if the world could make circular RNA the way we make circular RNA for products, nobody would make linear RNA products anymore, because circles have advantage upon advantage over lines and no disadvantages. There's no trade-off. There's basically fewer, better, more bits and pieces in to get a circle to work than there is for a line. So it's just... It's funny because, of course, the mRNA is our RNA. It's how our structures are encoded. So naturally, we try and mimic that in the product, and no one knows what circles do. But as a biotechnology, as a product, the correct answer is circles. It's not the way we do it, but the correct version of a product should be a circle because it's more stable. It's easier to make. It's far cheaper to make. It's made at high yield. You can make them much larger. You can express them much higher. They hang out in cells much longer, and they package much more efficiently in the lipid nanoparticle at the end of the day.
Mm.
So they're just better in every way.
Yeah. What's the take on the market right now in terms of other companies that are looking to develop and capitalize on circular RNA? I mean, are you one of a few, one of many? Make him honest on this, Andrew. You cover the space. You follow the space. There's no one else like him.
It's getting hotter and hotter.
It's getting hotter and hotter. I think, you know, we were first out there with these claims, and then I think many people have come along and corroborated the claims, I think, to their own satisfaction. So I think we've got to get in on this action. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, though, that there's, as far as I'm aware, there's only one way of making circles efficiently. And that's the way that Alex discovered in Dan's lab.
Hmm.
And we have an exclusive license to that. So now, having said that, there's more than one way to make a circle, and you can make it inefficiently if you wish. And if you, in the end, had a, you know, 1 gram of circle made this way and 1 gram made that way, it's still a gram of circle. At that point, then it's, well, what does it encode? What are the other differences in the molecule? But, you know, in terms of ease and efficiency, I would say ours is made in one step, to be clear. There's no capping. There's no tailing. There's a single enzyme, which is the polymerase. There's no capping enzyme or tailing enzyme. So there's no mods. We don't need mods because circles purify more readily from the contaminants in the in vitro transcription reaction for which you need the mods. So if you don't have the mods as contaminants, then you don't need the mods at all. And mods are much more expensive than regular nucleotides. So our cost to make a gram of finished stuff is like 1/10 to 1/15 of mRNA.
Yeah, there's some real... Yeah, there's some really nice supply chain benefits to working with circular RNA. And I think, too, you know, just the field talks a lot about the clinical benefits as well, or, you know, the hoped for clinical benefits in the future, right, in terms of overcoming some of this, just the stability, the durability limitations that we've seen with linear mRNA. So I've been watching it really... I've been watching it with a lot of anticipation to see where it goes, because I have been watching sort of the numbers of pipeline products, right, start to creep up in the circular RNA space. It's getting some more respect and some more attention. And I really liked what you were saying earlier, too, because it's, you know, you were talking about it, sort of the iterative innovation, right, that the entire space is sort of going through, and how you approach failure and the challenge of working in a potential area that still has yet to really find its future, right? I think the RNA space as a whole, particularly on the encoding side, right, your mRNAs, your self-amplifying, your circular, still have a long ways to go, right? I think in terms of efficiency of development and their biological impacts, right? So I'm really curious to kind of pick your brain on how heading up in a circular RNA company is challenging today, right? Especially since we are still trying to figure out, I always kind of call it the mRNA identity proposition, right? Within the advanced therapy space, within the biologic sector. How do you, you know, how are you navigating some of the risks of working with a very novel technology today? And how does that impact your leadership strategy, right, of a company that's kind of been paving the pathway for this modality?
Yeah, I mean, the risks we embraced are substantially more than the ones we've been talking about, because, as I mentioned, the first thing we were meant to do was go find a lipid, a particle, mm-hmm. which would naturally deliver to immune cells. Such a thing did not exist. Mm-hmm. Such a thing was never suggested to have even been possible. Everyone kind of thinks these things go to the liver as a default. Mm-hmm. So not only were we trying to develop circles as a novel payload and promulgate the idea that they don't need mods, which is iconoclastic. In fact, you know, a Nobel Prize has been given on the need for mods. And there mm-hmm. we are saying, well, you don't actually need them if you use circles. I'm not saying it wasn't a great idea. You know, I myself have received linear RNA vaccines, but mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. Technology evolves. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to do this thing with delivery as well. Mm-hmm. So we were doing two things. So, you know, my feeling was, yeah, this is not going to work.
I love the honesty.
But, you know, so how do you do that? Basically, it's exciting what you're trying to do. The vision is there.
Yeah.
And some people are always drawn to that exciting possibility. They're risk tolerant, I guess, like I am. That's always mm-hmm. true in the early stages of a startup. I mean, NPM was a very good, solid name in terms of the venture backing. So there was good funds available. But, you know, you also have to have a backup plan. Okay, what do you do if this doesn't work out? And so we had all that. But in the end, you know, we actually got it to work. And so that was an amazing day, you know, that we could deliver to immune cells and they would take up the circles. The circles would express, they'd produce a CAR protein on the surface of Ts and NKs and macrophages. And then those cells would go and attack other cells in the animal, just like a CAR T does. So mm-hmm. that was pretty amazing. And, you know, we showed that. So we, you know, our innovations were not only academically that we showed how to make This is the broader way, of course. This is Dan's lab, but you know, Orna and its origin story, you know, showed how to make circles that was possible. We showed how to express from circles. We showed that it was possible to find an immunotropic lipid. We showed the value proposition behind doing that and what you would do to get that to work. So we have blazed a whole series of trails as we've pushed into this, and you know. One of the challenges, obviously, when you start out is also that it's very hard to be noticed. And it's good companies being started all the time. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Intellia, it was a luxury because you're noticed. I mean, editing, everyone would notice every single thing you would do. Mm-hmm. People were lining up around the block to join the company. It's like you could pick and choose whoever you want to come. It was that intense. And RNA was still very, it was very hot at the time. Mm-hmm. The pandemic had started and there was mm-hmm. some value in the vaccines. But you still, you know, you try and be noticed. And one of the things that was surprising, I still don't really understand to this day, is that the idea that the RNA could be circular seemed to capture the imagination of reporters or people who like to write about it. Mm-hmm. In other words, it wasn't like, oh, we've got a different cap structure or we do mods a different way or something like that. So the RNA is circular. It just seemed intriguing enough that we got noticed early enough. And because we were sort of the first one out there, and because it's right there in the name, we kind of became, I don't want to say synonymous, but we certainly became like the name in the space. So it was a little bit of luck being hot, a little bit of sort of marketing. But there was also that inexplicable, I don't know why circles capture the imagination, but they just do.
They're so poetic.
I mean, yeah.
And your ornicorns, I mean, come on, you know, it's the myth is just baked into your company.
There it is.
You talk about being first on the scene. It's funny. I was just thinking about an episode that dropped a few weeks ago, an episode of the Business of Biotech that I named The Innovator's Dilemma. It was with a friend of mine, Brian Finrow at Lumen Biosciences. And we talked about that concept of being first on the scene with a new technology or a new approach and how it creates awareness potentially inherently, right? It's something new, but it can also create tension. It can create challenges around getting people to spend money on you. You've mentioned NPM a few times. It's fantastic to have a good strong partner there. But I guess take us behind the scenes a little bit around when you're revealing something new to the community, not just the scientific community, but the investment community. What goes into ensuring that you're winning the funding you're going to need to move forward and hit milestones?
Yeah, I think it has to be the logic of the idea. I might even say the logical ineluctability of the idea. The premise here was that cell therapy is fantastic from an efficacy perspective, but it's so cumbersome, so difficult, so challenging for patients. They have to be managed so intensively that there's the cost of the therapy and then there's the adjunct costs of just administering and managing the patient during the administration of the therapy and the risk associated with that. And so the idea was, well, if you could just do the manufacturing inside the patient, not at the bedside, actually just in the patient, that would make everything go away. And that's self-evidently true. The idea that if only you could, then that would be great. That's an easy sell because that's obviously true. The question is, well, how the heck do you do that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
At least our attempt, which in some ways didn't have to work, but it was a shot on goal. And but there was no name for what we're trying to do. Now the field is called in vivo CAR or in vivo CAR-T. So there are some groups that are trying to do it through adapted viruses where the viruses will do the job of delivering. Now, of course, they tend to then integrate into the genome. Some viruses don't, but like lentivirus vectors will integrate. And ours is transient, but it's redosable, which a lentivirus is not. So when you get to that point of showing that it works, the value proposition is self-evident. Okay, it's like, if only you could do this, like teleportation. Yeah, that could be useful. Okay, can you do it? And so if you do a little demo, I don't have to explain what you would do with teleportation. You can take, your mind can take it from there. So I just have to show you, look, particle, animal, boom, cell's gone. tumor gone, people go, I like. here's money. Yeah.
here's money. Matt, we really picked the wrong career.
I feel like I picked the wrong question. Dr. Barnes's answer was like, well, because it works, dummy. Hey, people.
You're millions of dollars.
Here you go. Yeah, it's interesting too. Like sometimes I have a hard time. My mind, I'm a slow Pennsylvania boy, right? Like my mind doesn't keep up. Like the you mentioned earlier the prospect of sort of leapfrogging RT, and that just kind of to me that's kind of mind blowing. Like you know, CAR T is still new, and if you talk to CAR T people, they're telling you like, oh, we haven't yet scratched the surface of the indications that we can tackle.
Yeah.
Right. We're making great progress in solid tumors and so on and so forth. So I'm curious about your perspective of how the CAR T community might, I guess, receive Orna's news that that Orna thinks it can kind of leapfrog CAR T, and specifically how would Dr. Carl June feel about the prospect?
Well, our Series A was interesting because new investor, we had venture investors up until that point, but every new investor we had in the Series A was a pharmaceutical company that was doing cell therapy.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
So in other words, they were saying, we too see the value proposition and we wish to be close to this story in case it works out.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say embracing the potential and obviously in some ways, it's a competitive technology to CAR T, but it's much more pharmaceutical in a way. Whereas CAR T is a living drug, it will expand. You can't really control it. Whereas this, you can control the dose. It has a half-life. It has a maximum concentration, which then fades over time. And that's a function of the dose that you give. So this is much more like a traditional pharmaceutical in that way. And so there's CAR T companies that, of course, want to defend their turf and their franchises. But there's also many things about this that would be appealing to a pharma player that isn't in cell therapy, because those who might have find cell therapy a bit fiddly would probably find LNPs, whilst more fiddly than a small molecule, a lot less fiddly than a cell therapy.
I think that's an interesting point too, because we live therapeutically within the ATMP space right now, right? And so everything's kind of been marketed or positioned as this one and done, right? Which I think can have sort of a sexy bit of allure, right? Especially for a therapeutic that can be very expensive, right? The prospect of a durable, potential cure, right? It's not everything approved has been curative, but that one and done does have some appeal to it. I'm curious to you, but the fact that I think, too, investors can be aware of if RNA is a chronically dosed therapy that fits similar to a biologic, right? That sort of that risk proposition is understood, right? It's well known. But I'm curious, do you find that navigating the funding today has changed at all, right? I mean, as more players come into the space with RNA, as the space, we're not mature by any sense of the word, right? But as we have moved beyond the pandemic realm, are you finding that, there is investors are interested in different types of information or data, or, has getting funds become more challenging in any way?
It's an interesting question. I think, as a company progresses through its stages, as its own story advances, its pipeline advances, mm-hmm. then what you want from or need from the funding and the scale of funding you need, it inherently changes. So you're not appealing to the same necessarily. You start with a venture appeal, and then later on you're appealing to different kind of later stage investors and ultimately pre-public investors and ultimately public investors. And these investors are all looking for different things, different proof points. They typically, you can probably distinguish them based on their own risk tolerance profile of where they feel their sweet spot is and where they like to get in. In terms of our story, our story resonates, but in the case of Orna, it resonates pretty well. What we're trying to do is relatively differentiated. So it's not just the name that people remember, but they too do tend to recall that we're doing what we call now pan-CAR, because our lipids don't just deliver to T cells. So if you have a lentivirus, it's going to find the T cells because it's a T cell tropic virus. Whereas our particles are pan-lineage. They go to Ts, NKs, and macrophages. And so to the point that people feel cell therapy have only scratched the surface, yes, you have some people doing CAR Ts, you have some people doing CAR NKs. Mm-hmm. You have whole companies doing CAR Max, CAR Ms.
Yep.
Well, we do all three with one injection. We create all three with one injection. So that's why we call it pan-CAR rather than, and we call it in vivo CAR rather than in vivo CAR T, because we're reaching all the effector lineages in the immune system. So, you know, people like that. And the potential that we could do something in solids is there without having to change anything of what we do, because we're in the macrophage already. We just have to think about what the target is. What does the CAR target?
Yeah.
But there are companies out there already trying to blaze a trail in CAR-Max space. Mm-hmm. We content right now to be looking at relatively tried and true targets. This is one of the, I think, rules of bringing new technology forward, is you don't want to stack your risk. You don't want to try new biology and new technology.
Mm-hmm.
So our technology is new, so we are using a fairly vanilla target.
Okay.
Helps us compare and contrast, but it also helps everybody understand what you have in that way. So
that's an interesting point.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about upshot. I'm curious, Dr. Barnes, what your, like, if you do a risk analysis of the company between now and your next, like, big important milestone, what could go wrong? I mean, she laughs because, like, you know, a lot.
All of the things that can go wrong can go wrong. Mm-hmm. There's a large number of them. I think LNPs are no different. The RNA is no different. You can have timing delays. You can have manufacturing snags. You can have translation issues. You know, ultimately, whatever you've seen, you get a different result in people. It's drug development.
Yeah,
it's a low probability business from where you start to the chances that you'll get an approval. Right, you have to start so many threads so that one of them is going to make it all the way through. But you try and shorten your odds by getting the right kind of proof points in animals in vitro ahead of time. You shorten your odds by using a known biology. There's many things that can go.
Yeah, I probably should have qualified the question a little more.
Liked it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean,
it's a great question
with a lot of different answers.
Enough about it, that's for sure.
Yeah. If I were to narrow that question, though, I probably would have asked, like, organizationally, structurally, you know, in terms of people, talent, manufacturing capacity, mm-hmm. like, assuming the science goes as well as science does during drug development. Mm-hmm. What that's within your control as the you know, captain of the ship, are you potentially anticipating a challenge around?
Well, there's a lot of good companies competing for talent, so everything that happens is done by the people in the company. So you have to be good at, as a group, as a company, as attracting talent. And when people are here, it's got to be an environment where they like to stay. They can always leave. The best retention tool that you have people not want to leave, not golden handcuffs or other sort of perks. Just create an environment where people feel seen, heard, appreciated, where they feel they participate, they understand what's going on. Something I've always striven for is transparency as much as I can, so that everybody has a common sense of what we're doing, where we are, what's going on. Obviously there are limits, but as much as I can. And I think that tends to help people buy into the mission. One of the things that people often say after they've interviewed here is that everybody said exactly the same thing in terms of what we're doing, what the mission is. There's no duality or multiplicity of views because we all have the same, we have a common view. So I think that that's people talk about culture as being important. I think it often comes across sounding very platitudinous, but I think culture is very important in terms of retaining people, because when you're in a good one, you know it. And then, you know, things do go awry or sideways from time to time. And that is when the true value of culture emerges, because that's if like, well, I'm here because, you know, the pay is good and we're on a ride, I'm waiting for my stock to vest. And then it goes south. It's like, oh, my stock isn't worth anything. Like, well, everybody's out the door. I mean, if it's a place that people don't want to be at. But if it's a place that people do want to be at, they say, well, you know what? I'm going to stay. I'm going to see this through. And that I think, is the real value of having a place where people like to work.
Yeah. You mentioned it's a competitive space to find talent. Is that more specifically so when you're dealing with circular RNA, or are there transferable skills perhaps from people who've worked in other labs and other modalities?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of transferable skills. RNA is still hot, so you know, it still, I think, attracts talent. Circular RNA, perhaps a little better than another linear RNA company, unless it's an editing company. I think editing still has cachet in that way. Yes, it would be it'd be different if we were doing a new kind of small molecule, a new kind of chemistry, or it's an old kind of chemistry but a new kind of target that we've chosen here to take biological risk, because, hey, we found new targets. That's what we're going after. That's the hypothesis we're going to test when we get to the clinic. I think it's just, unless you're good at telling the story or there's something really compelling, that tends to inspire a little bit less readily than, you know, gee whiz technology.
Yeah. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. Time flies when you're having fun.
I know.
You know, we are going to run short on time here. So I'm going to shift gears. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your partnership strategy. I think you mentioned you found solid support from pharma, you know, biopharma companies, and you've got specifically partnerships with Merck and Renegade Therapeutics, maybe others. So share a little bit about those partnerships and what sort of your strategy as the leader at Orna has been in establishing those partnerships.
Yeah, so the strategy, I think, that noise is not coming through. The strategy really derives from the fact that we have a true platform. People like to say they have platforms, and investors like
everybody. Everybody says they have a platform.
Investors like to invest in platform because it means if the first thing doesn't work, you've got a second thing. The alternative to a platform is a single asset play. But it turns out that's not a binary thing. Platforms, or at least an approach which give two or three products, okay, that's most things. It's less common to have a platform that could really do a vast number. Editing was one, certainly. Because a lot of the liver targets are all picked over. But in the early days, it was all there. It was all there to be done. And it's almost like this embarrassment of riches of the number of things you can do. And the same is true for RNA, for our approach. We have fewer people than Moderna, but we are doing fundamentally the same thing as Moderna. We are putting a long coding RNA into a particle and administering it IV. That's what they're doing. Our RNA has a different shape, and we have other advantages. We think that we can do it, and their delivery is different than our delivery. And that's a fundamental thing. It's not the topology of the payload matters, lines versus circles. You know, I argue circles are better, but they're not necessarily the killer app back here. I think the real killer app is the delivery. We were the first to show immunotropic lipids. Now everyone's looking for them and trying to replicate what we've shown. But until we showed it was possible, no one was really doing that. So in terms of partnerships, then, you look across all the things you could do, and there's like, oh, my God, there's so many things that you can do, and you can't do it all. I think the mistake a lot of companies do is say, mine, 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 we're going to do it all. One of the things I like to say, I like to challenge people, is how many products does it take to make a successful biotech company? The answer is one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how many of these things do you really need? So it kind of defines the partnering strategy. We picked the area. We declared we're going for in vivo CAR. That's what we're going to do. And we will, this doesn't mean the partner is off the table, but the kind of partnership we're looking for is going to be very different, more selective, narrower. And everything else that we can do, we'll partner that. We'll partner that out. We're opening to partnering that out. And so that is the basis of the Merck relationship, which is primarily focused on infectious disease. So we were, weren't going to do anything in that space, particularly we were a little bit late to the party. But we even before the pandemic, we were founded not to do vaccines. We were founded to pursue in vivo CAR. So that's what we're doing. Now, the relationship with Merck goes a little bit beyond infectious disease as well. I think they have had relationships with other linear RNA companies, and so that they have an interest in the space. So it goes a little bit beyond that. In the case of Renegade, Renegade was a company, also came from the same stable. It's another MPM company. It was founded about 2 years after us, and it was going to address the delivery question. So it's going to be delivery-focused, not payload-focused. It was going to be relatively payload-agnostic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we thought, well, okay, we could always use some cool new delivery. So that was the that was the relationship with Renegade as they were building things out. Now, of course, they one of the places they started to see is could they get a better vaccine lipid? And so you know, the relationship with Merck came along at a time when we already had some early hits out of that. And so that the Merck deal is actually a three-way deal between Warner, Merck, and Renegade. Mm-hmm. But we continue to work with Renegade on other things. So there's another deal with a Chinese company called SimNova, which is a member of the SimSea family, and that was an opportunity to, from our perspective, firstly doing excellent work there, discovering novel binders, novel CAR proteins, which they're clinically validating themselves. So it was a way to potentially get access to that, but also to get access to accelerated clinical evaluation through a particular setup that they have in China called investigator-initiated trials. It's just it's something that most Chinese companies do, and something that we could do with them in our collaboration. So that was appealing to us as well. I like to think we were already thinking globally, but actually there was a practical angle to that.
Yeah, yeah. What about clinical opportunities in Australia? That seems to be all the rage right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of not so much the investigator initiator, in terms of formal evaluation, the Australian environment is obviously, it's a top-notch medical society, you know, medical healthcare society. It has typically simpler review processes, shorter times. And there's a particular interest in drawing RNA investment into Australia by governmental agencies. So there are various financial incentives of going down there as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's positioning itself quite nicely as a hub over the past couple of years. It seems like there's a lot of really exciting mRNA stuff going on in Australia.
Well, we don't want to hype it too much. We drew Dr. Barnes to Boston. We don't want to lose him to Sydney. In the time that we have left, let's talk about where the space is going.
I've been somewhat obsessed, so I'm going to selfishly ask the next question because I'm really curious to hear your answer. I feel like I might already know it, just given your love of ORNA, circular RNA. But I'd really love to you know, I often am talking about the RNA toolbox, the identity proposition that the different modalities can play within the broader biologic space, even just within the mRNA sector as a whole, right? You know, moving from, I think the space in general is moving towards some of these next gen modalities more regularly away from the linear mRNA for a number of different reasons. But I'm curious to hear, you know, how you foresee circular RNA really fitting into or perhaps dominating, you know, do you see it fitting into more as one tool, right, in the toolbox, applicable, you know, kind of only in very specific use cases, or do you see it being used in partnership with a lot of different mRNA therapies and biologics, or do you just kind of see it dominating the space, right? Does it become the one to throw in a Lord of the Rings joke, the one ring to rule them all? I mean, you're welcome to steal that as well, by the way, but Thank we you. Might get in, we might get in trouble with the Tolkien
copyright.
Seat.
Yeah,
yeah.
you know, it's an interesting question. So the right now there are certain IP barriers to getting into mm-hmm. circular RNA, but in the academic world, of course, that they're free to do research, and I think there's a lot of circular research going on right now using the method that Alex and Dan invented, because it's just so easy and they don't have a constraint that way. So there's going to definitely be ongoing research and with circles or what you can do with circles. The main limitation, though, the thing that will limit its reach is how many different delivery solutions you can. If all you have is liver delivery, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day whether it's a circle or line. You might get slightly different performance. But what is really going to push things forward is the delivery question. Mm-hmm. And at that point, if you were forced to suffer with the mere linear RNA, but you had a very, very cool new delivery, you can make fine products with that. And you're not nothing's prevented in that way. Mind you, if you had the circle, it would just be easier and better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people are going to continue studying natural circles. That still is a bit of a mystery what they're doing there.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are going to do some technical innovations. An area where we've been focused technically on the circle side is how you get expression, because there is no cap, there's no end to the RNA. So you have to mark the start of the protein with a different sequence element. Now single-stranded RNA viruses use a trick to do that, and that's where we're drawing our inspiration from. But we've been doing, I think we've been leading in that space. We've been the first to really explore that in more of an omics way. And so we're really trying to define the universe of possible ways of expressing, at least as already instantiated in nature. Now, obviously, you could go to random sequences, but amongst those that are out there, and there's a lot that are out there, so it is a little bit daunting. And we use omics approaches, we use machine learning to get after all that. So I think, notwithstanding the IP barriers, I think there will continue to be a lot of interest in circles, and there'll be a lot of people trying to, you know, work their way around those patents in some way or other. Maybe they'll just be straight up very clever ideas that are very different to the ones that we have that get you there. And once you have the circle, you will enjoy all those advantages. Now, of course, you still have to express. And so that's why we think the expression system might be another line of defense. I know you're trying to think about opening doors, and here I am talking about closing doors.
I think that's an important conversation to have, to be honest. You need to talk about some of the potential door closers as well, right? I mean, this is new, and there's a...
You want to protect it. I mean, that's where our value is. But, you know, when you look across the modalities, and there are companies now doing tRNA.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that it's basically nonsense suppression, stop codon suppression. So all those genetic diseases which have a premature termination codon, you know, maybe one therapy. It's a very intriguing idea, and so on. So there's going to be continuing approaches with RNA. Not, I think, less about circles versus lines, but creativity will emerge in other ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tRNA or we see RNA editing as something that's out there now, or there'll be other kinds of RNA splicing things that are going on. I mean, so there's, you know, there'll be RNA this and RNA that for sure. Okay.
Yeah. Whole universe of opportunities that will work in parallel, most likely to each other, right? Not just, you know, one ring to rule them all, right? Yeah. One solution.
not if Dr. Barnes has us. Dr. Barnes, what 2020 was an interesting time to start a biotech company. What do you wish you knew then that you know now? And whether that answer is specific to just biotech leadership in general or specific to the RNA space?
So I'm a first-time CEO. So back when I was starting, you know, I had to at least have the courage of my convictions that I could do a halfway decent job at it. I learned what it really feels like being a CEO. I'm not sure I would, just get ready for the ride is maybe what I tell myself, but I'm not really sure my younger self would have even understood, you know, oh, it'll be like this. Yeah, I think you have to sort of live through it to really sort of sense. It's a very central role, I think, at the CEO level, particularly in the early days. You basically have to do a lot of different things because you don't have the team is not fully fledged. But then, you know, as it grows, then what you're trying to do shifts and evolves and changes. And, you know, there's raising money, you know, is the story good enough? How did, you know, polishing your craft in terms of pitching and getting people interested in what you're doing, getting the message across succinctly or in an exciting way. You know, and there's your board as well. And, making sure you're, everything is very smooth and aligned there. I've been in any number of board meetings before as a participant, but not as, you know, CEO, which is a far more central function in that. So that was maybe the newest thing to me because I'd done early stage startups before where I didn't have the title CEO. I was basically doing everything anyway. So the early phases of Orna were very familiar. Yes, I don't know that there's advice. Just to say that you know, it's a lot. It's a big role.
Yeah, there's advice in all of it. You know, I ask questions like that all the time of my guests, specifically like scientists turned CEO, and the answers are wildly varying. But there's meat in all of them, right? Like someone's going to take something away from it. So just one follow up to that, and then we'll let you get on with your day. You said, get ready for the ride. Looking back, what aspects of the ride were you perhaps the least prepared for?
Well, we went through some interesting macro factors. I mean, I've been in biotech long enough. I've seen various macro factors as an employee. Things go up, things go down, but it was other people's responsibility in some ways to deal with it or ensure the health of the company. And, you know, there was the big boom time in 21 and then it all sort of went south and sort of the investment dried up. So, that's really out of your control. As you're presented with a scenario and you have to solve for what you're trying to solve for. And then if the conditions change, you have to resolve for that. So that's less, and that's not you. I mean, that's your team at that point. That's everybody from your board to your executive team to yourself. And then everybody in the company is trying to create value through what they do. I mean, the path to salvation is value creation. I didn't mean that for that to rhyme, but it did.
You're a poet.
And I don't know it.
Well, that's, the conversation's coming full circle.
Oh, my God.
Do you see what I did?
Oh, my God. That just
so happened. Anyway, that's the ride, I would say, in this particular case. You know, it could have been a very smooth, a steady period in biotech over this last little while, but it's definitely been up and down.
Yeah.
Prepare to wear many hats, in other words, right?
Well, I could selfishly continue this conversation for quite some time because I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I think co-hosting's fun.
It is fun.
Yeah, we're gonna do more of this. Yeah, RNA. I'm gonna find RNA companies so that I can just
RNA companies pitch Matt
and the light lifting and
you'll get this.
Dr. Barnes, we really appreciate coming on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. A lot of fun. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Aros.
We will we'll revisit maybe, you know, down the road when there's another inflection point to talk about. We'll catch up with Orna. But in the meantime, thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So that's Orna Therapeutics, Dr. Thomas Barnes. I'm Matt Piller.
And I'm Anna Rose Welch.
And you just listened to The Business of Biotech. Listen and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Sign up for our Business of Biotech newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. Drop us a line with your guest and topical ideas. And as always, thanks for listening.